Well, our son, our daughter and son-in-law are actually in New Mexico this morning. They are driving west. They're on their way here. And I was thinking about them, and it reminded me of a time when I made a similar trip with a group of friends. There were eight of us. We were driving in two cars. We were driving from Texas out back out to California. And, you know, that's a miserable drive, you know? It's just nothing but desert, you know? And in this particular drive, we were driving, it was the middle of August, and our plan was to drive all night through Arizona and Eastern California to try to avoid the heat of the day in that miserable desert. And in the middle of the night, as we're driving somewhere in the most desolate part of Arizona, the engine of the car that I was riding in suddenly just stopped. We're driving down the freeway 70 miles an hour, and all of a sudden the engine just quits running. And all of a sudden we're just coasting, and we coasted to a stop. And this is, it's like 3 o'clock in the morning, and we are in the absolute middle of nowhere. And our friends in the other car, we were following them. They had no idea. They just kept going. And of course, this was in a day when cell phones were yet a thing of the future. We had no way to let them know that we had a problem. In fact, we had no way to let anyone know we had a problem. We're stranded on the side of the freeway in the middle of nowhere in the middle of the night. So, you know, we got out, opened up the hood, and of course we had two problems. First is we didn't have a flashlight, so you couldn't see much. It was dark. And the second was none of us in the car knew anything about engines, you know. The other guy looks at me, he says, "Well, what do you think is wrong?" And I said, "It's broken." All I've got, you know. And so, you know, we tried starting the car again, but the engine just going, nothing happening. And I began reflecting on our situation. I thought, when was the last time I remembered seeing any sign of civilization? And it had been a long time in the past. I thought, well, there's no hope that way. So all we're going to be able to do is just walk down the freeway, hoping we'll come across some remote, random sign of civilization here. And it was, you know, middle of the night, but it was already, I mean, it was still warm. It's Arizona. And I began thinking, what if when the sun comes up, we're still walking down the freeway trying to find some help? How hot it's going to be. And I started having these visions of movies I'd seen, you know, where people stranded in the desert and they're out of water and they're walking, dying, staggering. I thought, that's going to be us. Now, fortunately, our friends figured out there was something wrong, and they were able to loop back around and find us, and so we were eventually able to get out of the situation. I didn't die in the wilderness. I'm really glad. But that experience occasionally comes to mind when I read stories in the Bible that took place in the deserts of the ancient Middle East. And the fact is, there are quite a few of them in the Bible. In fact, the wilderness is a fairly common theme in the Bible. On a number of occasions, God spent time in the wilderness, and a wilderness as hot and as foreboding as the one I almost got stranded in. You know that for 40 years, Israel wandered in the wilderness. David spent considerable time out in the wilderness areas when he was being pursued by Saul. Even Jesus had his own sojourn out in the wilderness. And lately, it has seemed to me that in our church, I've noticed we have been experiencing quite a few people who are experiencing some real hardships in their lives that seem to be going on for a long time. They're having their own wilderness experiences. And so I thought, you know, maybe we should look at some of the wilderness experiences of people in the Bible to see if there's some message in them that can help us as we deal with our wilderness experiences. So that's for the next few weeks. We'll be doing a short series of wilderness sermons. And we're going to start with Moses in Exodus chapter 3, verses 1 through 15. Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. He led the flock to the far side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There, the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within a bush. Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. So Moses thought, I will go over and see this strange sight. Why doesn't the bush burn up? When the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, Moses, Moses. And Moses said, here, here I am. Do not come any closer, God said. Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. Then he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. At this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. The Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers. I'm concerned about their suffering, so I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians, to bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now go. I'm sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, well, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? And God said, I will be with you, and this will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain. Moses said to God, suppose I go to the Israelites, say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, well, what's his name? Then what shall I tell them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites, I am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, say to the Israelites, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, the name you shall call me from generation to generation. Okay, so one thing that we can see here is that Moses had to get over his previous life here. Moses, I'll briefly remind you of some of the significant points of his life. You know them probably, but he's born to Jewish parents at a time when it was perilous for Hebrews to be baby boys. The Jewish people had been reduced to slave status. They're living in Egypt. They're enslaved, but they are growing into a huge slave population. And so the leaders of Egypt became concerned that they were so numerous that they were afraid of a slave rebellion. And so they came up with a plan. We'll kill all the boys that are born to the Jewish people, and that way we'll limit their population. Well, Moses' parents tried to protect him by putting him in his own little life raft floating in the Nile River. He was discovered and eventually adopted by one of Pharaoh's daughters, who then fortuitously hired Moses' own mother to be his nanny and raise him. So Moses grew up actually as the adopted grandson of Pharaoh, the leader of Egypt, the king of Egypt, making him a member of the most noble family in all of Egypt. Now, he was fortunate to have his own mother's teaching about the God of Israel, but he lived in a polytheistic society. This was, in a lot of ways, an ancient analogy to our pluralistic society. You know, everyone can have whatever gods they want, they choose to believe in. There were dominant supposed Egyptian gods like Ra, the sun god, and Osiris, and Ptah, and many others, but if someone chose to believe in other gods, that was just fine. You kind of pick and choose whoever you like, you know. So I think about kind of like where we are, it has to kind of like pizza, you know. There are lots of pizza chains like Domino's and Papa John's and Pizza Hut, and then there's the local places like Borelli's and Best of One and Pizza Port and Manhattan Pizza and others. And you might have your own favorite of those pizzas. You might even argue with someone about which one's the best. But you let others have their own opinion, and in fact, you would even be willing to eat their pizza because pizza's good, you know. Well, that's how they were with gods. Everybody's got their own, and you just pick and choose. Now, Moses knew some about the God of Israel from his mothers, but what he knew was probably somewhat limited. You have to remember that at this point, when this incident that we're looking at this morning takes place, all of the information in the books of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, all of that information, they didn't have that yet. Israel didn't have that. In fact, all of the rest of the Old Testament they didn't have. They probably had some of the Genesis information handed down orally, but that was about it. So his knowledge of who God is was somewhat rudimentary, and it was probably mixed a little bit with believing in, you know, oh yeah, there's these other gods too. So remember that after Israel came out of Egypt, they spent 6 weeks while Moses was being given revelation from God on Mount Sinai. All that revelation he had been given, they did not have access to at this point, including among them, for instance, the Ten Commandments. They didn't have that yet. So, thou shalt not kill, they didn't know that. And that actually becomes a factor in Moses' life. In part because of his lofty position as a member of the royal family, Moses seemed to have some sense, I think, of personal destiny. So, one of the things that's going to happen in the wilderness and in this experience we're going to see is God's going to help him get over some of his previous Egyptian training and ignorance about who God is. But also he had this sense of personal destiny, probably because he was a prince of Egypt. And also somehow, and I don't know how, maybe God worked in his life, I think he had a sense that he was supposed to do something to help his people Israel, the Jewish people. In Exodus 2:11, it says, one day he saw an Egyptian taskmaster beating one of the Hebrew workers. And so verse 12 says, looking this way and that and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. He was going to rescue his people. And by the way, he didn't know thou shalt not kill, so he solved the problem. Best way he knew. Now, the next day, he actually tried to break up a fight between two Hebrews, sort of thinking, well, I'm sort of the guy who's going to help them solve their problems. Well, that didn't go very well. And then it became known that he'd killed an Egyptian, and he became on Egypt's most 10 most wanted list. And so he had to run away. So he ran out to the wilderness. So one of the things that had to happen is that Moses had to get rid of some of his fuzzy and wrong ideas about God. And while he was correct, he was destined to help Israel, he kind of had to lose the idea that it was up to him to make that happen. And that's part of what happened to him out in the wilderness. So what we see in this incident is that God confronted Moses in the wilderness. So he spends 40 years actually out tending sheep in the wilderness. And understand that this wilderness was not really a very desirable locale as a place to live. This was not the land of milk and honey. The incident takes place near Mount Horeb, which is another name for Mount Sinai. They're the same place. And today there is a traditional location for Mount Sinai that's in the Sinai Peninsula. Many scholars actually believe that's the wrong location, that it's in fact very possible that Mount Sinai was on the other side, the east side of the Gulf of Aqaba, which would put it in what is today Saudi Arabia. Very possible. That's what, either way, these were desolate, barren places. You know, they would have made a good stand-in for Tatooine, you know, on Star Wars. Just desert, barren. So what's happened to Moses is he's gone from being a prince of Egypt in one of the what was the superpower of that time in this heart of civilization to tending sheep out in Barstow. That's what's happened to him. He's living in a rusting out old double wide out in Barstow, you know. Got some lovely tumbleweed landscaping out there, you know. And so rather than being a ruler of others, he's you know, herding a few sheep. And I think, and this is just my speculation, I suspect that during that time he made peace with being totally unknown and insignificant, living in this nearly unlivable wilderness. But I suspect he never quite understood that he had this sense that he was meant for something greater. You know, it was there, now it's gone. Maybe it was just my own ego back in my younger days. God was letting the wilderness do its work in Moses. Moses had to get over his own sense of what he could do and who he was, and he had to get a better sense of who God was, and that all happened in the wilderness. And in this instance, it all comes into focus, this incident. First thing that happened here is that he learned in a vivid way that God exists. You know, I think he already knew that God exists, but that became real in a tangible and vivid way for him in this incident. We see that he saw this bush that was on fire. Well, you know what? A bush that's on fire out in the desert, that's not particularly startling. It happens a lot. You know, I remember when, actually just recently, Lori and I were going for a walk, and we were walking past the hillside that's kind of a just open terrain just west of where we live. And Lori commented on how lush and green it is after all the rain we've had. The brush is up high and it's very green. And, you know, we can remember when it was barren and black because there was a big, huge brush fire that roared through, burned down a bunch of homes, almost got to our neighborhood. And we can remember seeing the brush on fire, you know, and the flames leaping, and it's not a big deal. Well, it was a big deal, but I mean, it's not something I can say, oh, that must be the Lord. You know, it's just fire. So you look at this, you think, why does he think that's a big deal? The passage tells us that the amazing thing was that the bush was burning, but wasn't burning up. It wasn't being consumed. So that would be amazing in and of itself. But I have a suspicion, and this is really my speculation. This is not the word of God, so differentiate that. That there was maybe actually something else a little bit more going on here. What we have to remember is that Moses had never seen, other than the sun during the day, he had never seen a light brighter than a candle or a fire. Right? That was all they had for light in that day. During the night, all you had was build a fire, have a candle, that's it. We get used to, you go down to Petco Park to watch the minor league Padres down there, and, you know, they turn those lights on at night, and you can see a baseball from far away in that light because those lights are so, they have such blazing bright lights, and sometimes you're driving down the road, and somebody comes and has those intense headlamps. It's just like, I can't even see the road because those lights coming at me are so bright. We're used to seeing bright, bright lights like that. Moses wasn't. The only light he knew was the lights in the sky and fire. And so when he sees this bush, he sees this light coming from this bush, and he says, it was a light. The bush was like burning, but it wasn't burning up, I think. He was seeing some kind of brilliant light that wasn't actually fire, but that was the only term he had to describe it. He's seeing some kind of light over there that's just like, what is that? Psalm 104, verse 2 says, the Lord wraps himself in light as a garment. We just sang that, didn't we? When God led Israel in wilderness, he appeared as a pillar of light at night, pillar of fire. When Jesus was transfigured, according to Matthew 17:2, it says his face shone like the sun and his clothes became as white as light, brilliant light emanating from him. In Acts 26:13, Paul explained the change in his life when he went from being a persecutor of Christians to an evangelist for Jesus. And he says, about noon, King Agrippa, as I was on the road, I saw a light from heaven, brighter than the sun, blazing around me and my companions. Jesus appeared to him, and it was brilliant light. Revelation 1:16, when John was given a vision of Jesus, he saw that his face was like the sun, shining in all of its brilliance. I think that's what Moses saw. He's out there in the wilderness, and there is this brilliant light, something that Moses had never seen in his entire life. A light such as he had, the only thing he could imagine was it's like the sun, but it's right over there in that bush. No wonder he said, man, I got to go see what that is. So he goes over there, and when he arrives, he has an encounter with God. He had believed in God prior to this, but man, this is a whole new level of believing in God, because all of a sudden, God is meeting with him right there. It's easy to live with an intellectual faith. Yeah, God, yeah, he's there. I believe in God, yeah. But have sort of a sense of unreality to it. It's a whole nother experience when all of a sudden God kind of gives you a glimpse that he's actually there and active in your life. He's present. We and our family actually have experienced that in a couple of really minor ways. And it's a really kind of spine-tingling experience when it happens. One of them actually was kind of funny. Years ago, I read a book in which the author told this amazing story. He's a Christian who was backpacking with his family up in the mountains. And one day while they're hiking, he wears contact lenses and one of his lenses popped out. Oh no, you know, you don't want to go around with only one contact lens. And so they spent a long time searching. They could not find that lens. And he thought, well, here we are right in the middle of our trip. It's going to be days before I can get back to civilization. I don't want to have to spend the rest of the time going, I can't see, you know. But what was he going to do? That night, a little bothered by it, he just said, Lord, I want to enjoy this time with my family. I pray that somehow you give me some solution for the contact lens problem. That night, he had a dream, a vivid dream in which he saw himself on that trail, the very spot where the lens came out, and he saw himself looking, and he saw a rock in his dream. And in his dream, he could see himself bend down and find that contact lens on that rock. When he woke up in the morning, he thought, well, that was weird, you know, probably a result of my frustration. But he couldn't get the dream out of his mind. So finally, he said, you know what, I'm going to go back there and look. And he went back to the spot where he lost the lens, and he looked around, and sure enough, there was the rock he had seen in his dream. And he thought, nah. He looks down on the side of that rock, and there was his contact lens. It's kind of a doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo kind of thing. It's like, whoa, small deal, but that is just weird. There are some branches of the church, you know, the more Pentecostal, where you'll hear wild stories like that that sound kind of meh. This guy was not that kind of a guy. The guy who wrote the book was a really solid guy. Just, it was like, wow, no kidding. So here's the funny part about this. I told that story in a sermon in church, and our daughter, Carissa, who was away at college, happened to be there that Sunday. And she heard that story, and then she went back up to college after church that Sunday, and turned out that week, there was something she needed some money for that she had set aside, that she had to use this money for, and she was a starving college student, and when it came time to use the money, she couldn't find the money. She couldn't find the money anywhere in the house. She looked and looked and looked, couldn't find that money, and she was so frustrated. So that night, you know, she went to bed, and she remembered that sermon, that story in the sermon. She thought, okay, Lord, I need help finding this money. Could you help me find this money? That night, she had a dream. Vivid dream. She saw herself looking under the cushions on her couch. She woke up. She thought, nah. She went and looked under the cushions on the couch, and there was the money. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, you know? You know, those are little things, but that's kind of the sort of thing where you kind of go, whoa. You know, is maybe God's really here. There was one that wasn't nearly as trivial that happened to Lori. She went on a mission trip with our son, a group he was in, to Fiji and Tonga. I know, yeah, mission trip to Fiji. Yeah, where do I sign up for that, you know? While she was there, this happened at a time when Lori and I were kind of having a little wilderness experience of our own, because we were dealing with some really hard things in ministry, and it was really grinding on us, and we were pretty stressed about it. And while she was on this trip, she met this gal, a Christian gal in Fiji that was just a live wire, you know, and they just really connected. Didn't get to spend a lot of time together, but Lori just thought, really like this girl. She really loves the Lord, just alive in the Lord. The day that they left Fiji, this gal pulled Lori aside, and she said, you know, Lori, the Lord told me that you are going through some very hard times, and proceeded to describe things that she could not know that God had revealed to her. And she said, God told me to pray for you and to let you know it's going to be okay. Whoa. How did that happen? You know, that's just weird. That's just God saying, I'm here. And when you have a little experience like that, it's kind of a, okay, thanks, Lord. What a cool thing to realize that God is right here. Here's the hard thing about those experiences. They almost always happen in the wilderness. We were in a little wilderness when Lori had that happen. Carissa was in a little tiny wilderness when she had her funny little experience. And usually, those encounters with God happen when you are desperate and you have nowhere else to turn. So the second thing I want you to see is that in this experience, not only did Moses get a sense that God is real and he's there and he's present, but he got a glimpse of the glory of God. That first glimpse is in just seeing this light that was like something he had never, ever seen before. Here was a force, a power that was far greater than anything humans at that time could produce. Probably greater, well, certainly greater than we still could produce. But it's kind of interesting. I noticed this. There's this odd thing that happens. He approaches God. God says, take off your sandals. You're on holy ground. Why take off your sandals? You know, often people actually remove their shoes when they come into our house. And I know it's because they know they're in holy ground. They're near His Holiness, Rick. It's because we have very light-colored carpeting, and everybody goes, oh, I don't want to make your carpet dirty. If we had wood floors, they wouldn't take the shoes off. It's kind of funny. I was thinking about this removing sandals thing. It reminded me of a previous ministry that we were in when my son, Toby, actually helped lead worship, and he had a habit. He would take his flip-flops off when he helped lead worship, and he'd be barefoot, and I got some pushback from it. I got people that said, "Why? I don't like it that your son removes his sandals when..." And I said, well, you know, God told Moses to take his sandals off when he's in the presence of God, so I'll leave it to you whether he should obey God or you. Just saying. You know, maybe that's why I'm not there anymore. I don't know. Kind of beside the point. What is this removing sandals thing about, you know? So, interestingly, this was actually a widely observed ancient custom. It was a sign of reverence in ancient cultures. And actually, it kind of still exists today in some ancient Eastern, or in some Eastern cultures, where it is understood that you will remove your shoes before you enter someone's house. That's a statement that you are unworthy to enter this house, and you are dependent upon the kindness of this person to allow you to enter. That's what that's saying. The closest thing I think in our culture would be removing a hat when you're going to, you know, they're going to play the national anthem. You're supposed to remove your hat. It's a sign of respect or of reverence. So Moses comes. God says, "Take off your sandals because this is a holy place. You are in the presence of the holy, Almighty God." And Moses really gets this picture when, you know, God says, hey, I've heard Israel. I'm going to answer their need. They're being oppressed. And so I'm going to rescue them. So you go. Wait, what? You know, you're going to rescue them. So I go. You know, Moses, God says, you're supposed to go back and you're going to lead Israel out of Egypt. And Moses, after the humiliation of being chased out of Egypt as a criminal and spending 40 years in Barstow tending sheep, he's lost any arrogance or cockiness that he once had. He's lost his confidence, in fact. He figures he's doing all he's ever going to be able to do. You know, I can understand that. I've been a pastor for almost 38 years, almost as long as he was out in the wilderness. And I can assure you, I'm not thinking, you know, maybe for my next career, I'll go into politics. or maybe next I'll become an engineer. Not thinking that, you know. Moses can't imagine taking on the task of leading anyone. He thinks all he's able to do is lead sheep. He can think back and say, yeah, you know what? I do remember there was a time when I thought I was going to be a great leader and help my people, and that thing turned into a train wreck. It was a humiliating hot mess. I don't ever want to do that again. So color Moses reluctant on this deal. He doesn't want any part of this. He's thinking, you know, it's really cool that you came to see me, Lord, but maybe I should just stay here and take care of the sheep and you can go do that rescue thing all on your own. And God says, sorry, dude, done deal, you're going to go. So Moses basically says, look, I don't think this is a very good idea. And when I try to become president of Israel, nobody else is going to think it's good either. So I need to explain where this is coming from. I need to tell them that this is your idea, not my idea. But I don't know your name. So what's your name? And understand the problem. Moses is sure that if he goes along with this nutty scheme, he's going to show up to the people of Israel and he's going to say, I'm here to lead you. And they're going to go, who are you? We don't know you from Adam. We're not going to follow you anywhere. We wouldn't follow you to the chow line, dude. And he's going to have to say, well, see, this isn't my idea. God sent me. Of course. We get that a lot, you know. So when you talk to him, did God happen to give you his name and contact information so we could kind of check your references, you know? It's interesting. You think at this point, Moses and the people of Israel knew that God was the God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. He was their national God. They didn't even know what to call him. The Egyptians had Ra, the Canaanites had Baal and Molech, and Israel had somebody. We're not even on a first name basis yet. So God responds. And honestly, I think of his response as kind of enigmatic. I kind of think of it as the Popeye response. I am what I am. I'm Popeye the Sailor Man, you know. Oh, great, I'm going to go and say, oh, Popeye sent me. You know, great. What is that? I am who I am? What's that supposed to mean? Then God goes on and says, well, tell them I am sent you. It's bad grammar, you know. What? Interesting, in verse 15, God said, say to the Israelites, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. The word, Hebrew word translated Lord there is the, the word Yahweh. The Hebrew word for to exist or to be is Hayah. And Yahweh is the name that is basically derived from Hayah. It means the one who just is. And that's what God is saying. I am. Tell them I am. I am the one who just is. Moses got what God was saying. God was saying he is the one who exists in and of himself. That's not true of anyone or anything else in all of creation and all that exists. Everything else and everyone else exists because of someone or something else. Something caused it. But not this God. Nothing caused him, because he has always existed And everything that exists, exists because he caused it to exist. Colossians 1, 16 and 17 says, "For in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities. All things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together." When God says, I am who I am, that is who I am. I am the one being that has always existed and that has caused everything else to come into existence. I am the one being who holds it all together, and without me, it would all cease to exist. I have power over all of it because I created all of it. I know there once was a theory that that the universe, everything that we see, is in fact eternal. It has always existed. But science has come to the rescue. Science now has proven that the universe had a starting point. Whereas if the universe was somehow eternal, you would say, well, there's no need for a creator. But if we know, and we do now know, that the universe actually, there was a point at which it didn't exist and it came into being, it started, the obvious question is, how did that start? The answer is, God started it. There is a being so powerful that he caused all of this, that is so enormous, it's beyond our ability to comprehend. With a word, he caused it to come into being. That is who Yahweh, the God of Israel, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that's who he is. And Moses goes, oh, you're that God. Okay, all right then. I get now why this brilliant light is coming from here. That brilliant light shining where there's no reason for it to shine is an analogy for the one who caused the light to shine. Moses has realized this is a being beyond my ability to comprehend. I can't understand how he created this light to shine here. I can't understand how he exists eternally. I can't understand how he could create. I can't understand how vast and enormous and majestic he is. But that is the God that I am confronted with right here. And in that dramatic moment, after seeing the visual aid, Moses got the implication, if God says go, I'd better go. Which brings me to the last point, and that is that Moses discovered that God had something for him to do. You know, he felt inadequate, and he's going to have to get through some of that in a few verses after this story. But at this point in his life, he thinks, all I can do is, you know, take care of a few sheep. I'm not adequate to do anything else. I'm not adequate to lead those people. And God basically is saying, yeah, that has been the point of the last 40 years. No, you're not adequate. But here's the deal, Moses. I'm calling you to do something that no human is adequate to do. God was going to say, no human is adequate to create miracles that will cause Pharaoh to let Israel go in the first place. No human is adequate to create a path through a sea to part the waters so his people can escape destruction from the Egyptian army. No human can do that. No human can create a covenant with the Almighty God and the law that goes with it. No human can create food and water out in a wilderness for a huge group of people, food and water that did not exist. But if God, Yahweh, the one who is the great I am, can create all that exists in the wilderness, those little miracles are child's play for him. No, Moses, you can't do that. You are not adequate for that. But I am. So you go, and you let me work through you. Moses had to come to understand that his own ability and power, yeah, he was insignificant. You know, when he was young and he was an Egyptian noble, he probably thought he was somebody. He was somebody important. He was in the noble house of the most important nation in the world at that time. But here's the interesting thing about it. If God had never called Moses to do the task that he had for him, would you have had any idea who he was? Can you name a single Egyptian prince from history? I can't. He'd have been a nobody. He only became a somebody when he did what God had for him to do. God gave this insignificant, inadequate man a role to play that had eternal significance. What God had for Moses to do, nothing else would ever compare with. So Moses had to learn to say, no, I'm not adequate. I'm not sufficient. But God has something for me to do, and all I need to do is go where he tells me to go and do what he tells me to do. So, okay, what does it have to do with us when we are in our own little personal wilderness? Because we're all going to go through some wilderness times, aren't we? Some of you are right in the middle of it right now. Well, here's the first one. Be patient with the wilderness. There's one nobody likes. Here's the thing. It required 40 years in the wilderness for Moses to learn what he needed to learn there. So God may say to you, I know you don't like the wilderness that I have you in right now, but just stay where I have you and trust and let the wilderness do its work. You know, one time recently, Lori and I were transporting Ella, our little granddaughter, to her home. Little Ella was, 14 months time. She was tired, and she does not particularly enjoy being strapped into a car seat. And I get that. I know that it's safer, but could you come up with a worse plan than we're going to put a kid all by herself backwards in the back seat, So anyway, she's back there. We helped her out because Lori got in the back seat with her. And so she started getting a little fussy, and she starts saying, done, done. That's one of her favorite words, done, done. In other words, I want out. So Lori, the distractor, she got her phone, which Ella loves, and she started playing a video on her phone of little Ella. And Ella loves that. She is truly human. Oh, it's me. This is fun, Wow, this is great, So Ella's watching the video, and then it stopped, Ella was not happy about that, but Lori said, well, I'll get it started again. And then she hit a wrong button and she lost the video. Ella just started wailing, I want it back. She didn't say that, but that's essentially with a message. She got it out loud and clear, and Lori's saying, oh, just wait, Ella, I'll get it. Ella doesn't get wait, I want it now. I'm done. I'm driving and I'm thinking, wow, we're just like her. I'm going through the wilderness. I'm saying, done, done. Get something to distract me. Oh, it's not distracting me. God says, just wait. I don't like wait. I don't think Moses probably liked wait either for 40 years in the wilderness. But that's exactly what he needed to do to get to the place where he was ready for God to use him. And that's what's going to happen with us as well. So be patient when you're in the wilderness. Secondly, when you're in the wilderness, seek to see God's glory. The interesting thing here is that Moses wasn't seeking an encounter with God when he was in the wilderness. He was just surviving. And we can't force God to reveal his glory to us. We don't control that. God works in his own ways, but there is something we can control. Jeremiah 29:13, God says to his people, you will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart. In Matthew 7:7, Jesus said, ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened to you. God wants us to be blinded by his glory, to stand in awe of him. That's his desire for all of us. And he says, you know what? If you seek that with all your heart, I'll reveal that to you. I want you to see my glory. So ask. Make that the thing that you want most of all. Here's the problem for most of us when we're in the wilderness. We just want it to go away. We get focused on, make it stop. That's what I care about. Moses' experience tells us, here's the more important thing. When you're in the wilderness, what you most need is to see the glory of God. Pastor and author Mark Buchanan says, our greatest need in times of need is to see the Lord. When we get focused on the wilderness and just wanting it to stop, what that produces is frustration, resentment, manipulation. But when we get focused on seeing the glory of God, all of a sudden it gives us hope, and it can even give us strength in the midst of the wilderness. You know how if you're out in the desert at night, and look out on a clear night and you look up to see the stars, and you can just see an incredible display of stars, right? A magnificent, it's just like it's overwhelming, it's beautiful, it's, you know, you feel almost tiny when you see all those stars. You wake up the next morning and go out in the day and they're all gone. What happened? Somebody turn off the lights because they're concerned about energy conservation, you know? We're going to take care of the environment, turn the stars off tonight. No. What happened is the sun, a greater brilliance, comes out and washes out all those stars. So when we are in the wilderness and we have a tendency to get focused on the issues of the wilderness, when we see the glory of God, that is what begins to wash out the wilderness as we get focused on his might and his glory. So let's seek his glory more than anything else. And then finally, go where God sends you. For Moses, back to Egypt, not a place he was anxious to go, but it became the most important thing and the greatest thing he would ever do. Maybe the most important thing that almost any human would ever do. I suspect none of us are ever going to be in Moses' class as leaders, but God has something eternally significant for each and every one of us to do. And the way we do that is by following him each and every day. We get up in the morning and we say, today, I am going to go where God tells me to go and do what God tells me to do. That is my agenda for this day. Nothing else competes with that agenda. God, what do you want me to do today? How do you want me to relate to this person? What are the things that are most important for me to do today? And God may send you on a journey that you would say, well, that was not my plan. That's okay. It's God's plan. Moses went on a journey that wasn't his plan, but God used it in an eternally significant way. And as we go step by step each day saying, God, I'm here to do what you want me to do. I will go wherever you want me to go and do whatever you want me to do with this incident, with this person, with that circumstance. God is going to make your life eternally significant. The amazing thing is, it's when we seek God's glory and just follow his will, all of a sudden our life takes on meaning. And it begins to go somewhere, and it gives us strength, even in the deepest, most barren wilderness we ever experience. Let's pray. Father, more than anything else, we long to see your glory. We get so caught up in our own little lives, and we're like little Ella. Done. I want it to be over. And we get so focused on that, and all it does is create impatience, frustration for us. Lord, we want to be like Moses, seeing your glory, being given a role to play in your plan, not our plan. Help us, Lord, to be just obsessed, overwhelmed in awe of your glory, your goodness, your love, your majesty, your power, your righteousness, your wisdom, spread in so many ways into our lives. We love you, Lord. Help us to see your glory. Amen.